come today to Symbols 12. And this rounds out the first year, except for next week, which is the interval. Traditionally, I try to have some sort of a gathering at the end of the year, but because so many people are traveling at this time, we'll have it in mid-January, something like the third week in January, so that you'll have a chance after the lecture of the third week of January, which will be Vision 3. I'll have you all up to our house, and you can ask questions for a couple of hours and enjoy some pasta or whatever it is that we have there, roast horse, whatever it is that's cooking. And so set that aside if you will. Symbols 12 has a place that's very peculiar in the order. It comes at the end. It comes at the very end, at the closure of a structure, of a form. And yet this form cannot be exactly closed. It has to be closed to the tightest approximation, but still be left open. And so the first year ends with an interval rather than Symbols 12. Symbols 12 rounds out the form, and next week the interval allows the form to breathe, gives it a little bit of resonance. And it's that tiny bit of resonance, that little bit of opening, that is so important for conscious form. Conscious forms must be open. If conscious forms are not open, they devolve very quickly into box canyons, and they become the formations known as ideologies and habitual mentalities. They're the source of all neuroses. They're actually psychotic forms whose resonance are neurotic frequencies. And so we need to guard against this kind of thing, because the power of this kind of an education, which is always played down so that you will be comfortable in it, but is tremendously powerful and has the ability to raise your energies and focus your dynamics in such a way that you can, in time, learn to navigate your own destiny. For such a human being, nothing is written. In certain times of civilization, there are epical changes. They're called sometimes, because they're so radical in their change, they're called sea changes. The whole ocean is of a different color. At one time, about 2,000 years ago, one of the great symbols that had been effective for about 2,000 years before that had been the symbol of Isis, the symbol of life from ancient Egypt. But 2,000 years ago, in a sea change, for in a sea change, all symbols recalibrate. The Isis form became this. And this particular form of the Isis life sign is a precursor of monastic Christianity, when the cowled monk with the sleeves met like this became the sign of inner life. And there is a sea change in our generation too. All the great symbols are recalibrating. And this education offers a way to understand the historical past, not just to the extent of the last 2,000 years or even 4,000 years, but back into the very beginnings of our species. And our species, Homo sapiens, goes back well over 100,000 years, perhaps even 200,000 years, and the precursors back at least to about 4 million years ago. This education takes advantage of a phase form harmony in that past, and also shows us a possibility of a future. The next 2,000 years are going to be incomprehensible to those who have not been able to navigate in terms of the past. The present, certainly, as a focus, is no guarantee of understanding the future. The present, as a matter of fact, is a junkyard and is no way to live. The possibilities of human life, just to finish this little introductory speech, the possibilities for men and women are truly unlimited. The world as it stands now has no glitter for someone who can see. It's a dirty little sandbox, and it has very crabbed little games. And the men and women who will step out of that sandbox into the universe will make contemporary people look like third-rate actors. Now, in this education, Symbols 12 is a point of closure of the form, but as we said, all great forms that come to some kind of a closure leave a slight crack, leave the door ajar slightly. In a Navajo rug, the weaving of a Navajo rug in the spirit tradition always left one thread that was not worked into the composition, and that one thread was allowed to trail off to the edge of the rug. And the English translation for the Diné word for that thread is spirit trail. It was a way in which one's spirit could come into the rug and inhabit. I have in my collection a Biche rug, which was originally the kind of rug that was made for a horse. The Navajos, who were among the first of the North American Indians to master the horse as a part of their whole culture. The horse became a symbolic part of Plains Indian culture, and the great masters of the horse were the Navajo, the Blackfoot, and the Sioux. And in the Navajo way of riding a horse, there was not so much a saddle, but there was a blanket that was put on, a short little blanket. And this blanket, about the size of a prayer rug. And in the deep wisdom tradition of the Navajo, the sacred priest quality, the Yebiche quality of transcendent people, was put into this most practical of all implements, the saddle rug that would go on to the horse. And in that, one finds on the typical Yebiche Navajo saddle rug, on their spirit prayer rug, we'll find figures, usually three figures, and they're abstracted human figures, gods, who have one single thread that joined them and leads off the composition. Another tradition that has this slight openness to a closed form is in Zen. In Zen, the all-time great symbol is that of the circle made with the brush, the large brush. The circle does not quite close. And if you've ever seen a great sumi painter work, we'll have a table. And on the table, we'll have a series of jars of water and of inks in various concentrations, and a large crock of brushes. And in behind, there will be this screen of paper drawn taut like a drumstick, so taut and with nothing behind it, that the discipline is to take a brush and dab it into an ink and turn and make the circle and bring the brush back in one seamless movement. If you stop at any part, any nanosecond, you will tear the paper. Because the force, the dynamic, the energy is so powerful that only in a seamless flow will the energy distribute itself into the form. If the energy is slightly misdistributed, it will always tear. In true karate, if you hit someone, you're not very good. The whole purpose is to come very close and not touch. It's the same in any kind of a yoga. Any powerful yoga is so powerful, the ability to command the body is so complete that when you bring the energies of life to a focus, to a center, if you do not have that resonance of compassion there to let life continue, you will choke the body off and you will die. The discipline of yoga is so powerful that a body is brought to complete standstill. Not just heart attack, but mental goneness. You never come back. So one learns to have not a completed form exactly, but a completed form for all purposes. But one always has this compassion to let the form breathe, and so too, this lecture today, Symbols 12, is the completion of a form. And next week, the fourth interval, is that little bit of openness, the spirit trail, the sumi-e circle that has a little bit of breath, to put it in a more contemporary, prosaic version. Dylan Thomas once, in speaking about the art of poetry, said a good poem leaves a few chinks in its structure for the lightning and thunder to come through. We're talking here in the education about a quality of balance that in the most reoccurring way is talked about as pairs. The left and the right. The two hands. If you talk about them as polarities of yes and no, polarities on that scale, the more accurate you become, the more disjunctive they are. And it produces a wall in between the two. And it's very difficult to navigate between the two halves of a polarity, one of which is yes and the other is of no. In a time of great Soviet interrogation, the Russian poet Yevtushenko wrote a fantastic poem called The City of Yes and the City of No. Da and yet. And he writes about in the poem of the difficulty in his time. He was about 30 years old and he was always being banished back to Siberia. Only for Yevtushenko, he was born in Siberia and so it was home. So they were simply banishing him and sending him home to his friends, his family. And so Yevtushenko in his poem writes about the absurdity of a situation where human beings are divided into lives where this polarity of the city of yes and the city of no never meet. And if you're bad in one or the other, you're shunted off, you're exiled to the other. That somehow those who see the world compartmentalized into polarity believe that the worst thing they can do to you, even worse than death, is to put you into an opposite. And so, too, all of the demons of this planet constellate themselves around this kind of a wall. As soon as there is a wall, on either side, you have this kind of demonic foam of resistances that build up. This course is all about seeing not in terms of polarity, but in seeing in terms of pairs. Because the pairs, in their interaction, do not make walls, but they make membranes. And membranes have a permeability. There's an osmosis that's capable of happening. And so the foam of resistances that would collect along the inner surfaces of walls and polarities do not collect, but they add to this membrane interchange quality. If one looks at an organic body like ours, the membranes of the cell, every cell in our body, have embedded in them, in the membrane non-wall surface of the cell, little atomic ions. Usually it's calcium, sometimes it's potassium, occasionally sodium, but mostly calcium. So there's a calcium atom, or many of them actually, peppered around the membrane definition of the cell. And those calcium atoms are minus an electron, so they're ionized. These ionic channels are the way in which energy goes in and out of the cell. Otherwise, there is no way for the food that you eat to get digested and turned into energy and to go into the body and nourish the cells. If the cell walls were not membranes, if they were indeed walls, like a walled tissue, like cartilage, muscle, that kind of cellular density, and even there you have still ionic channels, say a metal plate put into the body. There, the elements have walls because they're completed. There's no ionization, so there's no channel. This education stresses life and not death. It's an education that's not geared, excuse me, like the academic education that's offered worldwide now, is a death vector. Which is why if you go to a university for 4 years, within 5 years of graduation, you won't be able to remember more than 5% of what you learned, unless you're using it. Because the living memory doesn't record it. It's only written in the sand of imagination temporarily so you can pass a test. It has no permanent effect. It doesn't add to you genetically. Whereas this kind of an education, whatever you learn, is not only there with you increasingly in your life, but because it is permeable, it's affine to the life process of osmosis. It not only stays with this physical form, but is transmissible. You can carry it with you. This kind of an education is good for all eternity. It's a whole different scale. And that's why in ancient India, the word, or rather it's two words that were used for this kind of education, is in Sanskrit, Stitha Prajna Darshan. And a darshan is quite different from what is usually talked about in our time, our decadent time, where there are so many phony yogis. The darshan that's usually talked about in this time is actually called, again, that language, Durbar, which is a kind of a military review. It's an inspection to make sure that the ritual elements are organized according to the protocol. Like a military review, where the commander reviews the troops and makes sure that everyone has the collars, buttons, the posture, the armaments, everything is according to the ritual comportment. But darshan is a seeing, it's a vision. It's an inner seeing. A darshan is the way in which consciousness sees. The inspectors of our time call it third eye. It has nothing to do with an eye. That kind of seeing is seen with an entire sphere of openness. It's no third eye, but entire sphere, which is why when you see the iconographical presentation of someone in that state, they always have a thought bubble around them. And the short form of the thought bubble is the halo. So the nimbus, the bubble around the person. When one looks at the first science fiction illustrations of spacesuits, one sees the spiritual vision of man born out of the earth and now has the thought bubble. Is able to be in space because one sees in cosmic terms. A darshan, not a durbar. Stitha prajna, prajna means wisdom. Stitha means steadfast, constant. So if you went to a master real yogi of the 20th century, someone like the successor to Gandhi, Vinoba, one would find here a book entitled The Steadfast Wisdom. Stitha Prajna Darshan, the first edition had an even more abstract cover. It's not a third eye so much, but it is a way of seeing in terms of sphericality. And as we began today, we talked about the way in which deep symbols transform themselves. How from about 2000 BC to about 0 BC, one of the most powerful symbols in the world in which we would be familiar and inhabit was the Isis symbol, the symbol of life, the Ankh. And the Egyptian Ankh transformed into this kind of a symbol, which is very much like the monastic person with the cowl and the sleeves standing in a kind of a meditative stance. And just as in our time, these great symbols are also going through transformation. One cannot see the new until one is acquainted with what was there before and with the way in which transformations work and happen. And the transformations are like adding a dimension. It's just as if you have a three-dimensional composition and suddenly you put it into temporal movement, into a fourth dimension. It changes everything. Or if you have a two-dimensional plane composition and you add a third dimension, everything changes. Or if you have one dimension and you add a second dimension to it. Or if you have no dimensions and you add a single dimension to it, a dot in Euclidean geometry is a focus without dimension. It's a zero dimension locus. When it moves, the movement of a zero dimension focus generates a line, and a line is a one dimension. And as soon as dimensionality comes into play, then you have the potential, the possibility of a confusion. A knot, mathematically, is a self-avoiding one-dimensional line. And so it always makes confusion. It never makes order. If you take a one-dimensional line and you add another dimension, you get a plane. If you take a plane and you add a third dimension, you get space. And then if you add time to that, you get a fourth dimension. And if you add consciousness, you get a fifth dimension. And you begin to build on these dimensional qualities, whole new ways of existence, whole new relationalities that were not there before. One of the great writers of our time, Teilhard de Chardin, learned to see with such vision. He was a paleontologist, and because the Roman Catholic Church didn't much like the way that he handled himself during the First World War, he was in trenches with a couple of wounded soldiers, and they asked him to give a mass, and he had nothing to use, and so he said, "I will just use the whole world. I will offer the whole world as a mass." And when that word of that got back to the powers that be and that ideology, they said, "We can't have this. It's the Gobi Desert for you." They don't say it quite so cutely. And so they left him there for 40 years. And when he was there, because he had offered a mass to the whole world as a young man, the only thing you can study in the Gobi Desert are rocks. So he studied rocks, and he developed this tremendous vision, and he began to talk about rocks as pre-life. He said, "They're not dead. They just don't have that extra dimension where the organic comes into play. It's there, but it hasn't come into play yet." And when he saw that rocks were pre-life, he developed this uncanny eye to be able to see rocks that were organic, that had that extra dimension. And so Teilhard de Chardin became like Louis Leakey, one of the all-time great 20th century shaman, able to see fossil bones from very archaic life forms that were indistinguishable from rocks for anybody else. You have to do chemical analysis to see whether they have any organic life in them, like the Mars rocks. But a human being can be tuned, can be sensitized to such a fantastic extent that they see that extra dimension. And when you can see that this fossil is from a life form and this rock is a pre-life form, when you can see that kind of vision is able to be adjusted upwards so that one learns to see forms finally, not only in three dimensions or four, but in five. And de Chardin could see five-dimensional conscious forms, time-space consciousness. And he saw that when he looked at man in this way, that man was changing. And that what had been a great bowl of variety that was developing also had a purpose of coming together. He called it the Omega Point. That in the far distant future, our species will come into a focus that will be truly cosmic. This kind of equality, some 2,400 years ago, the adding of a dimension to one's visionary capacity became slowly apparent 2,400 years ago, 2,500 years ago at the most, became slowly apparent to human beings on the vanguard. They began to realize that they no longer just saw in cut-out shapes, in the kind of plane figures that the mind usually has, until the mind is schooled and developed in terms of the mind. The mind tends to see in terms of cutouts. But as soon as the mind becomes tutored, is trained as a mind and not just as a brain, the mind begins to see in three-dimensional qualities. And we can see that the development at this time, on the very vanguard of human ability, jumped a whole order of comprehension. Before then, one had a sense that the most powerful way of composing composition, Edward Weston said in one of his day books, the great photographer, he said, "Composition is the strongest way of seeing." The sense of composition which had been, in terms of geometry, suddenly raised itself a whole order so that it was in terms of trigonometry. Instead of seeing figures in a plane, one was able to see relationalities in a sphere. And the sphericality, the first place that we find that sphericality given in a symbolic way so that it could be comprehensible, is in Plato's dialogue, the Timaeus. And in the Timaeus, he talks about how a sphere has very special qualities that are not there in the plane. A sphere, any locus on the sphere, has a deep resonant parallel to any other focus on the sphere. The entirety of the sphere, if one could see it not just as a wall, as a circular or a spherical wall, but see it as a spherical membrane. The osmosis in and out of a sphere has a very peculiar quality. Any movement out of the sphere, because every focus on the sphere has this deep resonant parallel, any movement outside of the sphere has a deep parallel with any other movement outside of the sphere, and so you have a quality which today we would call resonance. A sphere, when energized, resonates. And that resonance carries in such a way that every wave of the resonance is itself a sphere. Even though you would sensitize yourself to one recording of that spherical wave, the recording of it, that instance, would also have sphericality in it. This is a very difficult thing at first to realize. It's difficult to imagine, first of all. But once one does imagine this, once one makes that kind of a standing on tiptoe and you get this, a whole new quality of possibility opens up. In the 1200s, the great teacher of that time, Robert Grosseteste, means great head, who's the teacher of Roger Bacon, the greatest genius of that time, when the University of Oxford was one of the first kinds of places like this. It was a spherical learning. And Grosseteste used to teach, he would say, when you look to the sky after a rainfall and you see a rainbow, every part of the rainbow is a rainbow. Every water droplet in that rainbow is itself has a rainbow hue. It's not that water drops in the lower part are of such and such a color and water drops in the upper part are of such and such a color, but every raindrop in the entire rainbow is itself a rainbow. And it's that kind of a quality. In astronomy today, if you're taking measurements of a star's light, any photon from that star has the entirety, all the characteristics of the star in that photon. It isn't that one photon measures one little particle of a star, it's that every photon has the entirety of the star in it. And it's the same with us. Our reality has the entire cosmos in it. It's all there, complete, because we're a resonance. But that resonance quality is so difficult to sensitize to. It takes a lot of practice. You have to be a real musician in terms of life. But what's easier, although initially it seems harder, it's much easier to deal with, is not resonance so much, but consonance. Consonance is a harmony of it all. And so this education seeks to awake, seeks to evoke in you a harmony, a harmonic sense that there are others, not just yourself, who are in this kind of emotion, in this kind of a process, in this kind of an education. And this is why, though in more ancient times, yogas were meant just one-on-one. This is a yoga meant for the entire planet, all at once. And the more that there are participating, the more apparent is the consonance. And so this is an education for the future. It's an education that can reach 2 or 3 billion people at the same time, even with sirens going. Bring the sirens on. It's fine. Because the language and the form is osmotic enough to work it in. I don't lose track. Because I'm not keeping track in terms of walls. I'm there as a focus, and the focus can be anywhere. And the language still styles itself, can work anything out, even dramatically bring in the kind of motion of a siren, the way in which there's a Doppler effect to a motion, that it increases at a certain rate as it approaches, but it decreases at a different rate as it goes away. So that one can tell whether there's an approach or a recession to sound wave. And one can do the same to light waves. Light that's coming towards us shifts in the rainbow spectrum slightly to the blue, and light that's going away from us shifts slightly to the red. So that in astronomy, for galactic distances, they look at the infrared shift, at the red shift of the spectrum. The faster, farther away it's going, the more it shifts to the red. This is a cosmic size osmosis. This shows that the entire universe is characterized by the membrane and not by the wall. There's such a thing as galactic lasing, so that one sees two images of a very distant galaxy or quasar that are put into pairs, into reflective mirrored pairs, because of a deep gravity well that's there in the vast billions and tens of billions of years of distance. And so gravity lensing is again this kind of a quality that's there, and the very first indications of comprehension, the very first nibs on this plant of intelligence are in Plato in the Timaeus. It's there that he talks about the mirror quality. The mirror quality of the mind, the mirror quality that's evident there in the way in which the eye sees. When the eye looks to see, the eye itself records, like a mirror. And if you look at the image in the iris, be in the very center of the iris, in the pupil of the eye, the image will have an upside down quality, so that one in one's mind actually sees upside down, and it's only by a reconversion that the images are put right, and it's also backwards. Now, this upside down backwards quality was well known to people like Plato at that time. It was a quality that, in order to see realistically, one had to understand that there wasn't just one angle of vision. It wasn't just that there's a hand there, but that there are actually four possibilities of this hand at all times. There's the hand, and then there's the obverse of the hand, the other side of it. There's the hand, and there's the reverse of it. And not only is there the obverse, the other side, and the reverse, backwards, but the reverse has an obverse, which is called, in the logic of that time, the contrapositive, the diagonal. And so in order to really be realistic, one had to learn to see four ways at the same time. Now, it took a long time for this ability to seep down and maintain itself so that human beings could learn to just normally deal in this way. And for a long time, more than 1,000 years, this capacity for seeing four ways at once was lost. And when it came back, it was so treasured that a great epic of civilization was styled around the way in which the great journeys of life and death and in between could be taken with this four way of vision. And the epic is Dante's Divine Comedy, written in four different ways at the same time, so that you could read the Divine Comedy in one, two, three, or four ways at the same time. And you could take the journey to the underworld, and the journey to the overworld, and the journey to the in-between world, and knit them all together by a similar technique, by a similar methodology of a four-way, a quaternary, holistic vision. Now, this quality of seeing, when one sees in this way, when one is able to have a four quality to one's sight, all of a sudden, the structure of existence discloses itself to be amenable to a harmonic. And one learns that if one's seeing four ways at the same time, that one sees into the very structure of existence that it always occurs on certain junctures, certain levels, and doesn't occur in between. And at those junctures, in the time of Plato, they were made into a series of spheres. And because there were seven of these levels of juncture, the universe was seen as seven concentric spheres. And this became the index of the world. The Greek word for it was the hymarmene, the seven veils, the seven spheres. And that if one could see in a quaternary squared way, if one could have the great square of attentive vision, it even carried over into China, where the saying was that one could always tell a real Taoist because his pupils and his eyes were square, not round. And that when you saw the sage with square pupils, that's the one to listen to. If you looked at reality with the square pupil and the seven spheres, what one saw was a composition in trigonometric harmony. But that trigonometric harmony was such that it proportioned itself out into a pair of progressions. One of the progressions was by squares, 1, 2, 4, 8. The other was by cubes, 1, 3, 9, 27. And that if you could see in terms of the progression of squares and the progression of cubes, you could then understand trigonometry. Whereas if you could only see in a linear cardinal way, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you could only limit yourself to a plane, to two dimensions. You could only see flat figures. You could only see geometrically. And if your mind was not trained to a trigonometric theatricality, you would reduce everything down to a flat, two-dimensional surface. And so one sees the world in terms of cardboard cutouts instead of in terms of whole figures. Let's take a break and we'll come back. I can remember the first time getting into a really deep samadhi in the Sierras. I was in Sequoia National Park. And as you come into Sequoia National Park from Visalia in that area, the first thing that you see up the Kaweah Valley is this enormous granite boulder, this huge, enormous thing called Moro Rock. It's about 7,000 feet high. And I was about
a very naive 19 years old, and used to meditate at night. I would work in the daytime as a head porter, and because I was a head porter, I could tell other people what to do, and I could sort of sleep partially. So at night I would meditate, and I favored going out to Morro Rock and sitting on the crest on the top, about 8,000 feet above the San Joaquin Valley. But sometimes with a full moon, you would get this great, beautiful amphitheater of space, and got into deep samadhi one time, and was suddenly aware of hundreds of thousands of meditators, and came out of the samadhi, and I looked around, there wasn't anybody there. Then I got it, and I realized that the trees on that level were sitting together. And then I started to realize that there's more to it than you thought. Yeah, life is amazing. Then I would read Thoreau for real. He's like a bestseller. I spent 6 months straight up there, and finally I had to go down to Fresno to get a haircut, and I hadn't been out of the Sierras for 6 months, and hitched a ride with one of the garbage trucks and went down, and they let me off on a corner, and I stepped out of the truck. All of a sudden, there's this chaos, traffic and psyches and everything, and this was like 1960 in Fresno, which is nothing, right? But it was such a world, and I thought, how can people live here? And then I realized, well, I lived here. And that something had changed. That I'd geared down to, like, natural rhythm. And on natural rhythm, 1960 Fresno was insane. It was frenetic beyond words. And I thought it was very symbolic that I hitched a ride with a garbage truck to get there. So being like really conscious at that time of not getting stuck, I found the same garbage truck and went back up. I learned not to be superstitious, but to be very symmetrical. That way, whatever knots you tied, you untied them in just that way. And it was interesting. Except then that you get into this whole thing of like, being cautious about impurities, and you get Essenitis. Oh, that's impure. And then I remember running across the one of the little sermons by the Buddha about how when you take your begging bowl around to get fed, whatever is put in your bowl, that's it. And one day, the Buddha was going around, and this leper woman put some rice into his bowl, and her thumb fell off into the bowl. And as the sutra recounts, nothing happened to the Buddha. He ate, and as usual, when he was finished, and you washed out your bowl with sand in those days, went back to his practice of delivering teachings. The Buddha was the first, the historical Buddha, was the first to deliver intelligence in this kind of four-dimensional continuum. It had the trigonometric functions that are there in Plato's Timaeus, but in Plato's Timaeus there is a dramatic time sequence. There's the dialogue time sequence, which is actually linear. But in the Buddha, in his, especially in the really great in-depth sermons, the Digha Nikaya, or the long sermons, and the Majjhima Nikaya, or the middle-length sermons, and in those you find a lot of unfolding. We used one of the Majjhima Nikaya in ritual, if you remember, we use the Satipatthana Sutra, which is the Mindfulness Sutra, which focuses and positions one so that you free your attention from a ritual flatness. And when your attention is able to be three-dimensional and then take on a fourth dimension of time, you enter into a whole new realm of the world called mythic experience. And mythic experience has feeling intelligence. And the feeling intelligence comes because it has a four-dimensional continuum that's there. And when you interiorize a four-dimensional continuum, if your mind is not opened up, it reduces down. It registers simply as the plane of images that record on the rods and cones through the retina, through the pupil. And it takes a knack in order to see three-dimensional and finally four-dimensional world. And you have to learn to do that. And it's very natural. Usually people do that. But they do that as children in a natural way, and then they forget. And as they become adolescent, the forgetfulness, they become less dimensional than children. And then as they mature and become adults, they become even less dimensional, and they end up back at two-dimensional practicality, which they say, well, this is the world of fact. And people who see in four dimensions, well, they're just children. Or if it's someone older, they're childish. Or if it's someone that got to them, oh, they're just daydreamers. Well, is that right? Don't think so. But in order to add the dimension of consciousness, so you have a five-dimensional way of language working, that took a real special teacher. Pythagoras couldn't do it. The historical Buddha didn't do it. He said of that's an other shore, and that we have plenty of problems on this shore. But the first teacher to teach a five-dimensional continuum was Jesus. His language is five-dimensionality, really complex, amazingly full. And in a five-dimensional language, you can characterize four-dimensional reality on level of modeling. Can actually hold four-dimensional models and look at them if you have a five-dimensional context. So you get really powerful quality of intelligence. And from the ability to model five dimensions, you need something more. You need a context that's even more. And that takes a lot of practice to do. But an education like this can deliver you to five-dimensional conscious time space if you're just even moderately attentive. But the key to it is just simply to let it flow and let it work, let it happen, because the language is already packed enough that if you play cassettes of this, if you take a cassette of today's lecture and you play it every day next week, you should be able to hear something different every day. You'll hear some similarities, but you'll hear something different every day. And if you then montage what you heard each day, say, make some notes from each day, and at the end of the week, take that sheaf of notes, collate them, you should be able to be aware that there is a perspective that is more than just three-dimensional or four-dimensional, but there's a five-dimensional perspective that's there. And it'll sensitize you so that next year, because the whole cycle next year is about consciousness rather than nature. In fact, a better title for this education than any of the other titles that have been used is probably natural consciousness. That's what this education is about. But the way in which nature works is that it comes into existence, it comes into focus, it integrates, which is not just that kind of compacting. Unfoldment is an integral process also. A simple unfoldment integration is counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That linear cardinal series is an unfoldment of by ones, indexes by ones. You can count by twos if you want, 2, 4, 6, 8. You can count by tens, 10, 20, 30, whatever it is. That linear cardinal unfoldment is also an integration process. And nature favors that. She likes that energy mode. All of her appliances work by integration. But consciousness goes the other way. It has a different motion. It favors, instead of integration, it favors differentiation. And if you stay so that you only see integrally, you miss at least half of the cosmos. It doesn't even occur for you. Or what occurs is simply a reductive imaging on a screen. And though that screen and that imaging are in their own right fantastic, it's called imagination, there's no way that consciousness develops by imagination. It develops by memory. And memory is a complementary function to imagination. You actually need them both. But where nature likes imagination, consciousness likes memory. So that one then says Mother Nature, but memory is the mother of the muses. You get a whole different sequence order, a whole different parfait of excellence with memory. One simple way to focus for this is that there's such a thing as the ritual brain, but paired with it is the symbol mind. They're both objective. And they both are natural, and they both participate in the processes of integration. But the ritual brain and the symbol mind are quite distinct and quite different. And the bridging that connects them together is language. But the ritual brain also has nature as a connection. But the symbolic mind does not have nature as a connection. This is why the symbolic mind can be abstract. It can do that very delicate dance pirouette called abstraction. The brain doesn't abstract, the mind abstracts. And so the mind, if only left in the natural way, the natural sphere where the mind functions, is actually in some ways inferior to the brain. So that if you stay in nature, the body is much more trustworthy than the mind as an objective basis. Anyone who lives in nature knows you've got to use the body. Not the mind. And when you get into experience, then you have to use them both. You have to use the body and the mind for experience. But when you get into vision, you have to use the mind. The body is not all that good at vision. If you squeeze the body, it will release images. But it doesn't release vision. You have to squeeze the mind. You have to do an acupuncture on the mind. Then it releases vision. We say that the body stores memories of images, but what it actually does is it stores imaginative image base. It's the mind. that stores memory. And so there is a radical difference. And if one doesn't know this, you can go your whole life and never sort in such a way that you get used to it. Intelligence is always then compromised, and you're always having to check back in with whatever guru you're dealing with to see, am I getting this right? Whereas a really good education frees you. So there comes a time when you walk in your own way, wherever you want to go, whatever purposes you have. The ritual brain and the symbolic mind, they're like objective phases. We come back to our education for a moment here. We know that ritual and symbol are phases, and in between them is a phase called language. So that if you're looking in this kind of intelligent, structural way, language is the membrane in between body and mind. And you want to have a language that has its ionic channels in it, so that language, instead of being a barrier between body and mind, instead of splitting body and mind into a duality, because the language is so dense and opaque that it doesn't allow for energy exchange, you want a limber, kind of a dancer-type language, which has the ability then as a membrane to allow the body and the mind to do their stuff together. And they belong together. They work very well together. There's no reason for them to be of duality. There's no reason to consider them as a polarity. But one has to have an education that helps open up this membrane quality rather than make these defining walls. And as you find out, as you do this more and more, you realize that you're surrounded. You're surrounded physically by a world that is built on walls. You're surrounded by institutions that wall off human functions. You're surrounded by a history which has compartmentalization to almost a psychotic extent. You're walled off by little episodic dramas, so that even dramatic active movement could be characterized as scenarios. There was a drama teacher one time. She was an absolute genius. Viola Spoletta. She did a whole little series. It was like a little case that had cards in it. It was 206 variants. And all these 206 took care of all the variants of dramatic action, dramatic activity. And if you mastered them, it was even deeper than Strasberg's method. But it took a hell of a memory to remember all the different ones. Is it true then that activity is limited? I mean, it seems very vast, and yet in terms of total freedom and infinite development, 206 scenarios is not very much at all. Yes, it is true. But the limitations can be strictured even more than that. The I Ching has only 64 hexagrams, and it characterizes all change. But what it characterizes is not change itself, but the world in its manifest objectivity that is subject to these changes. And it is so limited, the world is very limited on ritual level, that a ritual world can be characterized by 64 hexagrams easily. And those 64 hexagrams are actually portions brought together. They're ratios. Each hexagram is a ratio of two trigrams. And there are only eight varieties of trigram. With eight different trigrams, one can characterize the whole world. What a limitation the ritual world has. But if you look at this in terms of a structure, as we were talking about earlier, you look at 8, and 8 is 2 cubed, 2 times 2 times 2. 64 is 4 cubed, 4 times 4 times 4. So 64 is actually 2 raised to the 4th power. And one realizes, why is there this kind of a structure? Why is it that that powers, exponentials, work in this way? And that brings one back to Plato's Timaeus, because he showed that if you go by squares or by cubes, you develop progressions that characterize the limited world in the way in which existence has to happen. So that when you look at later developments, when you look at this kind of intelligence developed to, say, scale of Sir Isaac Newton, who uses the same mathematics, he can characterize gravity and all kinds of universal things. And when you look at the formulas, they're filled with squares and cubes. E equals mc squared. Why is it c squared? Because these simple exponentials characterize the ritual existence of matter. And it doesn't matter where one would be in this universe or what universe one would be in, if there is physical matter, it falls into this kind of a distribution. If it doesn't fall into this kind of a distribution, it falls into its exact polarity, which we live in a universe of electromagnetic energy, where matter has a positive quality. There is an equal universe of contra-terrene matter, of negative matter, contra-matter, antimatter. But it also distributes itself exactly in these proportions. So that one has a peculiar kind of genius like James Clerk Maxwell, about 100 and some years ago, who worked out all of the equations for electromagnetic energy that solve either positive or negative. And because he was a Victorian Scotsman, they didn't want to talk about the negative solutions. These are like Darwin's primitive man. We don't want to talk about this. So they left those alone and just developed the positive. And out of that, you get early 20th century physics. And out of the negatives, you get late 20th century physics. Because we got really smart and we said, we want to understand the demons. The angels we can take, but the demons we've got to watch out for. So let's solve for the negatives. But the fact is that one can characterize a ritual universe, all existence, by this kind of symbolic index of proportions and progressions. And one can learn this. And the peculiar thing is one learns this kind of math, this kind of mathematic. One can also sing it because it's also music. That those scales, those sets of valuation and their proportions work both musically and mathematically. They don't fold exactly the same. There's a slight difference, but they're similar enough that if you learn the one, you could learn the other. And sometimes someone advances more in one than the other, and it seems like, this one is better, or no, this one is better. Someone like a Bach, who mastered the structure of the fugue, used mathematics and music to a degree of genius. And then long comes Mozart, and he outstrips the ability of mathematical proportions to follow what he's doing, and it takes a long time for math to catch up with Mozart's music. But finally, math catches up with Mozart's music and realizes, well, yeah, well, there's that structure is still there, but it's used in this genius sort of a way. And as soon as math catches up with music, math wants to outstrip music again, and you get Schoenberg, you get the 12-tone style. Well, at the same time, his friend Stravinsky says, well, okay, I want to have music outdo math, and so Stravinsky starts to make a kind of a music that would have surprised Mozart, but still would have delighted him later on because he would have been able to hear the music. Because Stravinsky is still very musical. But then the math catches up with Stravinsky, right away you get things like Stockhausen. And you say, well, it looks like math wins after all. And then you get a music like Alan Hovhaness, who just simply floats so far above the mathematics, it'll take another century for math to catch up, which eventually it will. One will have a mysterious mathematics at the end of the 21st century that will be just almost like an art form. The point is that our education now with ritual has come to this point of integration, where it could close, where one could say, well, we have the whole square. We filled all four sides. We see the square. That integration has this kind of a cycle. The movement of integration has a syncopation between objectivity and process. That when it happens naturally, there's always this syncopation. There's always a beat. There's always a cadence to it. Reality has a cadence to it. So that when one sees really intelligent men and women, I mean deeply intelligent men and women, who get all of nature at once, their lives have a kind of a rhythm to them. Not a ritual mechanical comportment, but nevertheless, an objectivity which can be noticed, and one could learn to do it that way. One could follow in that way. If one looks at an intelligent Paleolithic man and woman, like in the Blackfoot Okan, the last Okan given in the 1960s was actually filmed because they realized they weren't going to be able to put it on anymore for real. They didn't have enough of the sacred implements to do it. They had to borrow some implements to put it on. And I used to show that film in the mid-70s when I first came down. Yep, it's in Canada. The only way to get it is to guarantee that you can get this. And the Glenbow Museum in Calgary is very leery of loaning things to Americans because they have a lot of experience. The Canadian phrase is being in bed with an elephant. We know the Americans well. We wish them well, and we wish they would stay where they are. Thank you very much. But in that film of the Okan, one sees an incredible light of intelligence that's there in the ritual actions. One always supposed that the ritual dances are like primitive and like these are primitive people. But they're not primitive people. They're fantastically, vibrantly alive. Because the ritual comportment is woven into the symbolic mind. They think along with the dancing that they do. They don't think of the dance steps, but they modulate so that their mind's cadence is with the body's cadence. And when they're together like that, what you see is a resonance of charisma. There's no mistaking it whatsoever. That when the women's society comes out, and they come out by fours, and all their beautifully sewn costumes and the whole thing, and they come out by fours, and they move by fours. Every step, every movement is in fours. You get right away that this is not a mechanical repetition, but that this is a deeply resonant realism. And that they're moving in such a way that the whole of nature, all four seasons, gets to see them at the same time. Spring is looking on for its resonance, winter for its resonance, autumn for its resonance, summer for its resonance, and all four of the seasons see the same movement because they're all spoken to at the same time. And one doesn't see any clumsiness, nor does one see any mistakes. When the Horns Society comes out, the Itsukinae were very fearsome because they're killers. They're men who, in Paleolithic courage, go up against the big animals. And you have to really be firm in your technique to go up against male buffalo with a bow and arrow. You have to be very certain, especially a whole herd of buffalo. Even if you're on a horse, bareback with bow and arrow, it looked easy for Kevin Costner in Dances of Wolves riding the horse and shooting the rifle because the original of that shot was done by Yakima Canute in Raoul Walsh's The Big Trail in 1930. And he trained John Wayne, the young John Wayne, how to do that. And Costner, watching that film, got the technique. But Yakima Canute got it because he learned it from the Indians. It's really difficult on full gallop to shoot a rifle with any kind of accuracy. And to shoot a bow and arrow with any kind of accuracy and enough oomph to get through a buffalo's hide at full gallop on a horse with the whole herd thundering around you ready to do you in, it takes a lot. It takes that kind of courage. So the Horn Societies are these kinds of Paleolithic killers who are professional, like a Sanjuro, to wipe out a whole unit of special forces guys, real Rambos. When they come out, and you can see it on the film of the Okan, you see when they first emerge, there's a resonance of this ultimate death that they carry for whatever they direct it to. It's very scary. But when they arrange themselves in fours, and you see the men's in fours, and you remember that the Horn Society comes out after the Women's Society and that their dance is a complement to the women's, all of a sudden, instead of their fearsomeness being something which you would fear, they're protectors. And you feel security in their power. There are people. They're going to bring back food no matter what the conditions are. No matter what the weather is, they're going to bring back food. We're going to live. Because they have this kind of guts, this kind of courage. They have the guts of the body. They have the courage of the mind. Because courage is not in the body, it's in the mind. If you don't have your symbolic mind focused, it doesn't matter how well your body's trained. The body is going to respond and be indexed by the images because the images are much more powerful than the actions. And an image of terror that you haven't dealt with sufficiently before is going to crimp your body movement every time. You're going to flinch. And if you flinch big time, while you're fighting the dragon, that's it. You just hope your friends send flowers. Because that's it. But with a courageous mind, the courageous mind can index those images and redistribute them so that they bring the mind and body osmotically together. And the images, instead of dividing body and mind, they anneal them together. It's the alchemical term. It means that they come together in such a way that they meld. And one has something new. And when the body and the mind meld, men and women understand that because they can do this, in this body with their mind, they can use this mind to do that with other materials. One can take copper ore, and you can take a little bit of tin, and you can meld them together and make a kind of a metal which is much more capable of lasting. You can take many different kinds of metals and meld them together, and you can finally get to where you have something like tempered steel. All of this comes from using the mind and the body together, osmotically together, and using a kind of a language experience interface that's osmotic, like a membrane, rather than as a wall. But surprising as all of that realm is, as soon as that is affected, as soon as there's a meld, as soon as body and mind come together, as soon as they form an integral whole, that integral whole isn't just statically there, it's resonantly there. And the resonances of that are the waves of consciousness. And those resonant waves add a whole resonant dimension to wholeness. Wholeness is not just there, it's wherever it's going to resonate to. And the resonances are a part of the wholeness. So they have to be factored in, they have to be taken into consideration. And an education that doesn't do that is actually stupid. Pretty dumb. It's not worth paying for such an education. They should pay you. Whereas if conscious resonances are factored in, one increases the dimensions of the practical and the real. And then you have a scale of theatricality that not only makes the play, but makes life. Not only is all the world a stage, but a stage can also osmotically become a world. Then instead of having medieval dramas, you have Shakespeare. You have that kind of a scale of increase. We're tempted today to say quantum jump, but actually it's an indexing order. In integration, there's always this fluid parallel between language and nature. The way in which words are is the way in which nature is. Nature is never statically there, and language is never fluidly just one thing, a really fluid language scintillating. And the scintillation of a living language flows in parallel with the mystery of nature. This is why sometimes when language is used right, one gets a mythic quality to it. A vivacity, a life, a living language. But when a living language transforms, it adds a resonant charisma. It adds a magic that was not there before. There is a magic language which is even more powerful than myth. Mythic language is living already. It adds life. But magic language adds a charismatic resonance to it. And we're going to see in 2 weeks when we start with Vision 1 that the way in which conscious language works is whole indexing level above symbols. A language which is so powerful that it can style a whole mind. We use a magic language, we use a conscious language to evoke and bring out and stylize the integral cycle. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do it. A really good mythic language can't do it. A good mythic language can shape bodies, can shape existence,
can shape action. But it struggles 50-50 with trying to shape the mind. And it can't touch consciousness at all. So that even men and women who are wise on tribal level, they're very suspicious and reluctant about consciousness. Yeah, we know about it, and we're a little leery about it. That lady who's conscious, you got to watch out for her because she can do things. She not only touches the way in which the seasons are, but she touches the way in which the mind works. She can change one's mind. She can restructure mind because she has that magic language. So one has to watch out for this. That's the realm of the gods, a celestial level. And so on tribal level, tribal tradition is always leery of transcendence because it's perilous, it's precarious. One's uncertain about it. And the function of imagination is incapable of imagining consciousness. Consciousness cannot be imagined. It's like a two-dimensional figure trying to imagine three-dimensional world. Can't be done. Or a three-dimensional world that's static, trying to imagine what goes on when you add time. And it's not just a primitive thing. In the 20th century, one of the most sophisticated of all books on philosophy by a German philosopher who's become as famous as Kant or Hegel. His name is Martin Heidegger. And when he was at the apex of his ingenious mind in the 1920s, mid-20s, he wrote a book in German called Sein und Zeit, Being and Time. And it's filigreed to such an extent that it's almost impossible to read unless you're like some kind of intellectual yogi. But the book that he wrote is only the sketch of the first part. The second part was to put that first part in motion, in time, and he never could write it. Never did write it. Because as soon as you put the filigreed structure of the first part of being in time, into motion, that extra dimension crushes the fragility of it. He lived another 50 years. Well, what did he write about for 50 years? He wrote about the mystery of language. He wrote about those brilliant guys on the vanguard of modern thought that were the thinkers before Socrates. How far, expletive, out those guys were. The mystery of poetry, the mystery of language. He wrote a whole long essay, almost 100 and some pages, on the German mystic poet Hölderlin. And how Hölderlin's poetic language was magical in a way that it made odd things realistic. And whereas Heidegger was completely bowled over by this kind of language, Hölderlin's classmate, Hegel, was very used to that kind of poetic, magical language, the flow of consciousness. So when one reads Hegel's Phenomenology of Mind, he's already got a four-dimensional continuum, but what stymies him are the problems with five dimensions. That five-dimensional form is very elusive, but he's aware of it. That's the real illusion, not going from three dimensions to four. That was already done by Pythagoras. That was already done by the Buddha. You don't have to stew for 50 years. Not at all. That's 18-lane highway already. And the real problems in our time are not five-dimensional conscious space-time,
They're higher dimensional problems. That's where the vanguard is. Because these other things were handled 2,000 years ago already with great competence. You go to Plotinus 1,700 years ago, he works with five dimensions as if it were like yesterday's mail. What's the problem? And we live in a time where the problems are six dimensions and more, and we're using three-dimensional solutions to try and work with them. And of course, that's why nothing is happening at all, except just loss of traction. The only thing that's happening is that more and more, as every year goes by, more and more people have no traction on any level. There are no levels of power anywhere in the world, no special groups that can do anything. Because they're not educated. It's as simple as that. They're not current to where the problems are. And the curious thing is, in this universe, when someone gets to a certain level, the universe responds to them. And when they're able to handle certain problems, the universe makes those problems available. Mother Nature, not only as a mother, but as a lover. Lover nature. In integration, nature is a mother, but in consciousness, the universe is a lover. And in order to go into consciousness, one has to learn how to love. And if you relate to lover like mother, nothing much is going to happen. As a poet wrote in the 1960s, he said, the spirit of romance will simply put back on her skirt and go elsewhere. She's not going to fool around with you because you're boring. And part of the problem with modern man now in aggressive mode is that he's boring to the cosmos. She wants a lover, and what she gets is a bashful boy. That's not going to work. So an education like this is meant to open up not only the whole natural cycle, but also the conscious cycle, which includes art and history and science. And those realms are very interesting. They're not boring at all. They're full of charismatic five-plus dimensional realities, forms and processes that are challenging. We'll have an interval next week, and the interval will be the cloud of unknowing. And then after that, we'll go directly the following week to vision. And for vision, we're going to use a pair of texts. We always use these. We don't use them like crutches. We're not reading out of the text. We're not doing that. It's medieval. There's nothing to do with what we're doing. But we're using them like goalposts, to put something there so that our purpose has a way of initially orienting, and then we're learning to run full field. Yes, vis-a-vis those goalposts, but even when the game is over, we still use those techniques because we want to be able not only to score, but to leave the stadium, go out, because there's plenty more than just this game. So the goalpost of the pair of texts is to give us ostensible purpose, but it's not a limitation at all. The scale of this education is good for the next 1,000 years. Many star systems. So we're going to use a pair of texts next week, in 2 weeks, that are like goalposts, that one of the texts is from the 1st century AD and the other text from the 15th century AD. One of the texts was the great culmination of antiquity, and the other was the rediscovery of that culmination of antiquity called the Renaissance. We're going to use the Hermetic text of the Mind Shepherd, the Poimander, written at the same time as the Book of Revelation by John. And the other text is from the Apex of the Renaissance, On the Dignity of Man by Pico della Mirandola. Mirandola was a capricious young man when he was in his early 20s. he made up a list of many hundreds of topics that he would debate anyone in the world on and published it. And said, you can find me in Florence. Just on the outskirts of Florence, I'm at the Via Correggi with Marsilio Ficino and Botticelli and Michelangelo and the crew. And you can come there and we will argue on any of these subjects. That's the kind of cat he was. So we'll take Pico and the Poimander as our goalpost to begin vision. But as soon as that phase runs its 4-week course, we shift to the deep, mysterious, feminine mode of visionary memory. We go to Frances Yates and Hildegard of Bingen. Because when women get the conscious mystery of the cosmos, it registers in a different way than it does for men. For men, it registers in the symbolic mind. For women, it registers in the integral body. So that there is, again, a kind of a pair. And they have to learn to talk with each other. But if they talk only mythic talk, they don't make sense to each other. Nothing happens. But when they talk magic talk with each other, the resonances start to flow, the juices are real, and out of that comes a kind of a music that is more than just banging the drum. It's a music like you hear in Beethoven or Haydn. It has a harmonic line that can be filigreed to almost any extent, and it has a structure. After that, we'll be able to come to Shakespeare. Let's take a break and we'll come back next week.